The title of this this seminar is "Letter from a Birmingham Jail: The Black Lives Matter Remix 2016." And those of you who are not hipsters are probably wondering, what the heck is a remix? Well, a remix is taking a song that you may know that's grown familiar to you, and completely taking it apart and reassembling it in a new and interesting way. Young people are very, very familiar with that term. First came to the public consciousness during the birth of hip hop 40 years ago. So that's what a remix is. It's taking something that's familiar, a song, or even a story, and reassembling it. So what I'm going to do here is take Martin Luther King's brilliant 1963 letter that he wrote from prison, from jail actually, to be technically precise, after he was arrested. He was arrested on April 12, 1963, and it was roughly his 20th time being arrested. You know, it was somewhere in that area. Scholars are disputing it a little bit. And he was arrested for parading, for demonstrating, for boycotting, for trespassing, and for picketing. Pretty much just existing in opposition to the racist system at that time. He had defied a judge's order. The judge said, you're not allowed to do any of these things. You're not allowed to show any, and this is a Alabama judge, you're not allowed to do any of these things that are really covered by your First Amendment. So he was thrown into the most uncomfortable of jails in Birmingham. And Birmingham at that time was also nicknamed Bombingham. It had more bomb explosions in people's houses than any other place in America. Churches were bombed. Individual civil rights workers' homes were bombed. It was a real reign of terror. And so King was down there protesting that situation. Now, the letter from a Birmingham jail was smuggled out on the margins of newspapers. The newspapers in those days, I mean, try to picture or try to remember, some of you who are old enough to remember, newspapers used to be really, really big. The margins between the text and the edge of the paper were fairly wide. And what Martin Luther King did was with a little pencil, and because he was in jail for about 3 or 4 days, he wrote in the tiny margins of these newspapers his response to a letter from 8 prominent Alabama clergy that had called upon him to cease and desist his agitations. So the letter was a response to an open letter to the movement. And so what I'm going to read you now is my... Ooh, these are interesting little scribbles here. Oh, that's going to drive me crazy to have a wrinkle. Fast forward to... one other historical note. He wrote this letter in April, and the famous March on Washington was in August of that year, so August 1963. So he wasn't even the sort of fuzzy, likable Martin Luther King that a lot of people think about now. The content of you know, your character, Martin Luther King, the sort of gauzy, you know, nonpartisan Martin Luther King. I mean, he was perceived by much of white America as a revolutionary communist troublemaker, and that there was not any convenient time for him to protest as far as a lot of people were concerned. And so this famous letter, and many, if I can just like get a sense, like how many of you are familiar with the letter from Birmingham, the original, before I remix it? So, you know, a handful, which is what I thought. And so that's why I feel fairly confident that this will be, a lot of this material will be new. I'm just I'm making it contemporary. Black Lives Matter, as you know, is a very controversial movement that is a response to police brutality or the shooting of unarmed African Americans, which has been, I wouldn't even say it was, the numbers have gone up. I think what is happening is that the ubiquity of cell phones has made the capturing of these images, you know, much more likely, and so it's drawing more and more attention to a problem that has been there since MLK, since before MLK, basically, for the length of time that we had Jim Crow. And going back even before then. So the letter from a Birmingham jail is King's response to the 8 prominent clergy who called him out and said that you need to follow, you need to obey the state and not do anything that upsets the state. This is the remix. My dear fellow clergy, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling our present activities unwise and untimely. You are appalled by the refusal of San Francisco 49ers backup quarterback Colin Kaepernick to stand for the national anthem. You are scandalized by the chant, Black Lives Matter, because you feel it is exclusionary. All lives matter, you say, as you turn your back to any nuanced understanding of the situation. Seldom do we pause to answer criticism of our work and ideas. There are too many black men and women dying in the streets at the hands of law enforcement and each other to answer all the criticisms that cross our desks. But since you are men and women of genuine goodwill, and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, we want to answer your statement in what we hope will be reasonable terms. We should remind you that we are here in Birmingham, Tulsa, Charlotte, Minneapolis, New Orleans, Cincinnati, Chicago, Los Angeles, and San Diego protesting police violence against unarmed citizens, since you have been influenced by the view which argues against outsiders coming in. We have a stake in what happens in our communities. We are not troublemakers, instigators, or racial arsonists stirring up unrest for its own sake. We have been moved to do what we're doing because we're Americans too. We're tired of waiting for our fellow Americans to have an epiphany that what is happening to us is profoundly un-American. Every day, it seems, we're asked to engage in nonviolent direct action in response to a police shooting in which killing an unarmed citizen is deemed necessary to maintain public order. Black Lives Matter goes wherever we feel our witness is needed. We're here in these cities because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century BC left their villages and carried their "Thus saith the Lord" far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so we are compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond our hometowns to the blood-red streets of America. Like Paul, we must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. We cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham, Tulsa, Staten Island, Ferguson, Charlotte, Baltimore, or New Orleans. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with the narrow, provincial, outside agitator idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds. You deplore demonstrations taking place across America, but your statement, I am sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. I am sure that none of you would want to rest content with the superficial kind of social analysis that deals merely with effects and does not grapple with underlying causes. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in New Orleans, Charlotte, and other American cities, but it is even more unfortunate that the political structure left us no alternative. In any non-violent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustice exists. Negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. We have gone through all these steps from the days of Birmingham up until now. There can be no gainsaying that the fact that racial injustice engulfs this community. The ugly record of police brutality is widely known. Blacks have experienced grossly unjust treatment in the courts. In recent years, the killings of unarmed black boys and men has been documented on cell phone videos with a sickening regularity. There are the hard, brutal facts of the case. On the basis of these outrages, black leaders and organizations have sought to bring these officers to account. But the municipal authorities, mayors, and police chiefs consistently refuse to engage in good faith negotiation. We repeatedly ask ourselves, are we able to endure the ordeal of jail? We schedule our direct action program for times that will bring pressure to bear on the city for the needed change. Our protests are big so that we may make the evening news broadcast and attract cable news. We want CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News to cover us. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. Our citing for creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor may sound rather shocking, but we must confess that we are not afraid of the word tension. We have earnestly opposed violent tension, but there is a type of constructive, nonviolent tension which is necessary for growth. Just as Socrates felt that it was necessary to create a tension in the mind so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths, to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, so must we see the need for nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men and women rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiations. I therefore concur with you in your call for negotiation. Too long has our beloved nation been bogged down in a tragic effort to live in a monologue rather than a dialogue. One of the basic points in our statement is that the action that Black Lives Matter has taken is untimely. Some have asked, why didn't you give the police brass in these cities time to collect the evidence in each case? Things are rarely what they appear to be on video. There's always a reason not to act according to these people. They don't think the election of a Black president or a woman, we don't think the election of a Black president or a woman president will usher in a new millennium to America. Some police chiefs and some mayors are more responsive than others, but there's still a desire to protect all officers, good and bad, from the consequences of their actions. But Americans will not see this without pressure from devotees of civil rights. My friends, I must say that you have not made a single gain, that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. Lamentably, it is a historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture, but as Niebuhr has reminded us, groups tend to be more immoral than individuals. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, we have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation and police oppression. For years now, we have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every African American with piercing familiarity. This wait has always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied. We have waited for nearly 400 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of police oppression and brutality to say wait. But when you have seen brothers, fathers, and sons cut down at will, when you have seen hate-filled police officers curse, kick, and attack your Black brothers and sisters leaving a pool party, when you see so many smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your children why they must always be on alert around police officers, when you have to concoct an answer for a child who is asking, why do they treat Black people so mean? Why are they so afraid of us? When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are African American, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when a cup of endurance runneth over and Black people are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, revered clergymen and women, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. You express a great deal of anxiety over willingness to break laws. This is certainly a legitimate concern. At first glance, it may seem rather paradoxical to us consciously to break laws in our protests. One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal, but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. We would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. And law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. Sometimes a law is just on its face and unjust in its application. For instance, many of us have been arrested on a charge of parading without a permit. Now, there is nothing wrong in having an ordinance which requires a permit for a parade. But such an ordinance becomes unjust when it is used to deny citizens the First Amendment privilege to peaceful assembly and protest. We hope you are able to see the distinction. In no sense do we advocate evading or defying the law. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. We submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. Of course, there is nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience. It was evidenced sublimely in the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I can never pronounce Abednego, to obey the laws of Nebuchadnezzar on the ground that a higher moral law was at stake. It was practiced superbly by the early Christians who were willing to face hungry lions and the excruciating pain of chopping blocks rather than submit to certain unjust laws of the Roman Empire. To a degree, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience. In our own nation, the Boston Tea Party represented a massive act of civil disobedience. We have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that African Americans' great stumbling block in a stride towards freedom is not Donald Trump or the Klansmen, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly say, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another person's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises blacks to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. We had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice, and that when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerously structured dams that blocked the flow of social progress. We had hoped that the white moderate would understand that the present tension between African American communities and the police is a necessary phase of the transition from an obnoxious negative peace in which blacks passively accepted injustice to a substantive and positive peace in which all men will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. Actually, we who engage in nonviolent protests are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open, where it can be seen and dealt with, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up. In your statement, you assert that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But is this a logical assertion? Isn't this like condemning a robbed man because his possession of money precipitated the evil act of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical inquiries precipitated the act by the misguided populace in which they made him drink hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never-ceasing devotion to God's will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see that, as the federal courts have consistently affirmed, it is wrong to urge individuals to cease their efforts to gain basic constitutional protections because the quest may precipitate violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. We had also hoped that the moderate would reject the myth concerning time in relation to the struggle for freedom. Some white Christians have gone so far as to assert the following: all Christians know that blacks will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great a religious hurry. It has taken Christianity 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to truth. Such an attitude stems from a tragic misconception of time, from the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. More and more, we feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than have the people of goodwill. We will have to repent of this generation, in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless effort of men and women willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively in the knowledge that the time is always right to do right. You speak of our activity in Charlotte and Baltimore and Long Island and Cleveland as extreme. At first, we were disappointed that clergymen would see nonviolent efforts as those of an extremist. We began thinking about the fact that we stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the black community. One is a force of complacency made up in part of those who, as a result of long years of oppression, are so drained of self-respect and a sense of self-worth that they have adjusted to injustice. And in part of a few middle-class blacks who, because of a degree of academic and economic security, and because in some ways they profit from the status quo, have become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed by those who take advantage of Black Lives Matter protests to burn stores and to loot. Nourished by the continued existence of police brutality, this movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America and who have absolutely repudiated peaceful pursuit of justice and have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. We have tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of those who loot and burn the only CVS that serves their community. For there is the more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. We are grateful to God that the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now many of the streets of America would be flowing with blood. We are further convinced that if we are dismissed as rabble-rousers and outside agitators, and if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, many blacks will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in black extremist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what is happening to African Americans when it comes to police injustice. Something within has reminded blacks of their birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded that it can be gained. If one recognizes this vital urge that has engulfed the black community, one should readily understand why public demonstrations are taking place. If his repressed emotions are not released in nonviolent ways, they will seek expression through violence. This is not a threat, but a fact of history. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good for them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you? Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise. So help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps America is in dire need of creative extremists. We are grateful to those who have written about our struggle in eloquent and prophetic terms. Others have marched with us. They have languished in filthy, roach-infested jails, suffering the abuse and brutality of policemen who view them with contempt. Unlike so many of their moderate brothers and sisters, they have recognized the urgency of the moment and sensed the need for powerful action. Antidotes to combat the disease of oppression. Let me take note of our other major disappointment. We have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. Of course, there are many notable exceptions. We recognize that each of you has taken some significant stands on the issues, but despite notable exceptions, we must honestly reiterate that we have been disappointed with the church. In the midst of a mighty struggle to aid our nation, to rid our nation of racial and economic injustice, we have heard many ministers say, those are social issues with which the gospel has no real concern. And we have watched many churches commit themselves to a completely otherworldly religion, which makes a strange, unbiblical distinction between body and soul, between the sacred and the secular. And we have traveled the length and breadth of America protesting injustice. On sweltering summer days and crisp autumn mornings, we have looked at the church's beautiful buildings with their lofty spires pointing heavenward. We have beheld the impressive outlines of her massive religious education buildings. Over and over, we have found ourselves asking, what kind of people worship here? Who is their God? Where were their voices when the lips of Donald Trump dripped with words of marginalization and forced exile? Where were they when Donald Trump gave a clarion call for hatred? Where were their voices of support when bruised and weary blacks decided to rise from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? There was a time when the church was very powerful, and a time when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on, and the conviction that they were a colony of heaven called to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be intimidated. But even if the church does not come to the aid of justice, we have no despair about the future. We have no fear about the outcome of our struggle. Even if our motives are at present misunderstood, we will reach the goal of freedom all over the nation. Because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with America's destiny. Before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before the pen of Jefferson etched the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence across the pages of history, we were here. For more than two centuries, our forebears labored in this country without wages. They made cotton king. They made the homes of their masters while suffering gross injustice and shameful humiliation. And yet, out of bottomless vitality, they continued to thrive and develop. If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery could not stop us, the opposition we now face will surely fail. We will win our freedom because the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands. It is true that the police have exercised a degree of discipline in handling the demonstrators. In this sense, they have conducted themselves rather nonviolently in public. But for what purpose? We preserve the evil system. But for what purpose? To preserve the evil system that allows the slaughter of unarmed citizens? If we have said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, we beg your forgiveness. If we said anything that understates the truth and indicates are having a patience that allows us to settle for anything less than full equality, we beg God to forgive us. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King Jr. and Black Lives Matter. Before I began reading, I was remiss in not opening with a prayer. I literally just forgot it because I was so distracted with this. But let me address that now. Dear Lord, we thank you for this day, this great day, and for the opportunity to discuss the ministry and work of your peacemakers. The fact that they are often misunderstood and that they are not seen as vessels of your truth and righteousness. And we pray, Lord, that you will open our minds and our hearts to these historical examples, and that you would give us guidance as we discuss and wrestle with what these things mean in the context of our country and the context of our faith. We pray, Lord, in your holy name. Amen. So, I apologize for the length of this, but I wanted you to get a sense that there's nothing new under the sun, and that these are literally the same questions that we've dealt with since the 1960s. So, they are things that have really, at least when I look at what's happening, am I making anyone late for church? I hope not. Oh, choir. I'm sorry. Because I'm thinking, oh, my God. It's like, you know, now we got to hear the real sermon. You know, Black Lives Matter is like, if you turn on Fox News, it is like the number one devil in the country as far as many of the anchors are concerned. And I believe that's exactly how the civil rights movement, as we traditionally understand it, was received and how it was treated. It was treated as an alien, anti-American, unpatriotic, communist-inspired force. And that instead of seeing it for what it was, a movement that was deeply rooted in the black religious tradition, it was seen as alien. Now, I know that Black Lives Matter today does not have that root understanding of the world or reality. It, in many ways, it has moved away from Martin Luther King's, Christian presuppositions. Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Church and that whole movement were self-consciously Christian. Black Lives Matter is more of a hybrid. And that doesn't surprise me, because I think that pretty much every institution today is post-Christian, including the church in many ways. And so it doesn't surprise me, but I think that it's still rooted in a lot of the assumptions and approaches that Martin Luther King, spearheaded. And so when I see people just very cavalierly dismissing Black Lives Matter as just a movement of bomb throwers and hate mongers and all that, I take it very personally, because I see that as basically a return to 1963, when everyone who was involved in civil rights was regularly and routinely arrested and considered a traitor. And so this is something to keep in mind as we look at this. You know, if we can just put on new glasses and look at and try to see what they're attempting to do. Because you never hear from this movement a call for violence. You never hear that. What happens on the margins, you know, what happens when you see people breaking windows and setting fires to CVS and all of that, these are literally thugs who are taking advantage of, you know, this opportunity to create mischief. If you recall, the very last protest that Martin Luther King was involved in Memphis before he was assassinated also ended with people breaking windows and overturning cars and doing stuff like that. And we all know that King was not for any of that, yet it was still attached to his movement. Because that's what happens in this country. You have people who are genuine, who are up front, and then you have people who are exploiting it, who are in the back, waiting to take advantage of the situation. So I just want to bring that to the foreground here. If you read King, Martin Luther King, even if you read someone who was considerably more militant, like Malcolm X, you will find an amazing prescience. You know, it's almost like they were able to look 50 years into the future to where we are today, because the things that they protested in their very divergent ways are still with us. What we don't have today are spokesmen who are, you know, as who are at the level of a King or Malcolm X or James Meredith or any of those folks. You have a much more bureaucratic civil rights movement, and you have a much more secular civil rights movement than you had 50 years ago. And I think that that's a direct result of the fact that the source of the civil rights movement was the black church. And I, at the risk of really offending you know, many of my black pastor friends, I find the black church to be guiltier than the quote white church in allowing a generation of people to come forward, of young people to come forward, without any sense of responsibility for, you know, this American dilemma. The black church as a whole tends to be more movement called prosperity gospel oriented, which is the worst thing in the world. It's not just a function of the black church, obviously. I think it's the prosperity gospel, that whole, what's his name, Joel Osteen thing, that has been democratized, and it is like it goes across the country, and it tends to be what church is all about, you know, complacency, making people feel good, not being awake to the fact that that there's terrible things happening in this country that require churches as really the last bastion of people who are self-conscious about what churches, synagogues, mosques, the last bastions of people who are self-consciously standing in the breach with God, trying to bring about you know, change that is for the good of all of us. The black church has fallen down on this, and so I certainly don't blame the white church. The fact that there is even a white church and a black church is in itself an indictment. 50 years after Martin Luther King so eloquently complained about it, pretty much in every sermon, it's still the case. So we're in the era of Black Lives Matter, where we can just see the issue of police brutality almost as like a microcosm of everything, of all the ails in our society, and because it's not the only ailment. It is the most symbolically dramatic. And so I know I threw out a lot of stuff here, and I'd be curious to get a sense of what you folks think, and maybe have some back and forth if someone wants to open up. Yes, sir.
I Mm-hmm. And know the community pretty well. And I know, and you, everybody knows that the shooter in that case was black.
Mm-hmm.
The chief of police was black.
Right.
And the chairman of the county commissioners was black.
Right.
Now what's the problem?
What do you mean?
Why did that community react as it did when those people who should have been very sensitive to black matter, lives matter, why did that erupt like that?
Oh, well, because I think that it's safe to say, as the son of a former cop, that it doesn't matter if you're black or white or whatever. If, as a cop, you tend to think it's us against them. And I can tell you that anytime I've been hassled by cops at all, it's been black cops. So, I mean, the issue is not a black cop is going to be more sensitive than a white cop. I mean, that's just an erroneous assumption. The problem is that in Charlotte, they refused to, the authorities refused to bring forth the evidence or any of the cell phone evidence of the shooting. And so their shooting was contested, and they were saying, well, we're not going to bring forth any information.
Yeah, they were protecting the police.
Right. Right, right. So, I mean, it's like black, white, Asian, you know, it doesn't matter what color the cop is. If they're part of a system that devalues, you show up and within 10 seconds you shoot someone without really checking the situation
the
out.
Is how the people in charge
right.
Reacted.
It's just,
so
yes. Right. Right. It doesn't matter. I mean, if someone said 99% of the American police force was black, that wouldn't change anything. I mean, it's the mentality there that says, okay, you can arrive and within 10 seconds you can shoot someone. It's like, or if you look at something that was really blatant, like Tulsa, with the police woman. Who shot the man whose car had stalled in the road, and she had backup, four other cops, and she shot an unarmed guy with his hand on the car, and her defense now is that she is suffered from temporary deafness, which is like this new thing, you know, like she was so focused that she could not hear her colleagues backing her up. She thought she was alone, even though the video clearly shows that she was not alone and that she was aware that they were there. She's now claiming that she suffered from temporary deafness and did not realize that she had backup and thought she was alone, and still does not explain why she shot a guy with his hands on the car, you know, roof. You know, she still doesn't explain that. But that's the kind of ridiculous stuff that we're talking about.
But in a community like Charlotte, mm-hmm. there's a lot of black people.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
Why do we have, I don't understand why do we have this hidden movement, Black Lives Matter?
Because If black people continue to just be shot and said nothing, then it would be even more normalized than it already is. I mean, you have to object to something that's wrong. You can't just assume that it will stop and that people will come to their senses. There needs to be a change in the culture of policing in America in order for that to stop. And if it happened to someone you loved and someone that you cared about, it really would dramatically. I always say this. Every time you hear of a police shooting, just imagine it was someone that you loved or someone that you knew. Wouldn't you have questions? We have questions whenever a kid comes home from, you know, daycare, and you know, there's a little rash on the leg. We say, well, how did this happen? What caused this? And so forth and so on. You know, for minor things. If we don't feel that same way about people who are left literally on the street for 2 and 3 and 4 hours while the cops are, you know, investigating, when will we feel that? And I think that that's part of the whole, that's part of the pain in all this. Yes?
I guess two anecdotes that really made me stop and think were, when a friend of mine who's a, you know, fairly calm thinker about these things, commented that somehow we managed to apprehend.
I know where you're going with that.
The shooting at the police,
Yeah, shot five cops. Yeah, shot at five cops.
Yeah. And so why is it that we can't arrest an unarmed man
without telling him? Yeah.
And then the other one that really captured my attention was listening to Michael Steele, the former
RNC chairman. Yeah.
I'm a father, and I'm trying to figure out what I can tell my male children to do when they encounter the police, because it seems like if they put their hands up, they might get shot. If they don't put up their hands, they might get shot.
Right.
I honestly just, you know, I don't care about all the politics around this. I just don't know anymore what to tell my children to do. So they'll be safe and not wind up dead. And I, you know,
yeah.
That was, you know, he's not a person who has words about
right
political positioning, but it was a very honest moment, I thought.
It was, and I actually saw that on TV, and I said, you know, good for him. The thing is like in the case of Tulsa, the guy had his hands up, and the cops are saying, well, it's not enough to have your hands up. You now have to be kneeling, you know. And it's always like it always gets ratcheted up, you know. So okay, have your hands up, kneel. Well, now you have to say I give up, or whatever else the next thing is. And so, or someone who's mentally ill. There are lots of mentally ill people in this country. You know, the estimates are as much as 1 in 5 Americans are mentally ill. Why don't police have training to deal with someone who's muttering, who may be mentally ill, who may be under the effects of narcotics? I mean, narcotics should not, just because you ingest narcotics, should not be a death penalty offense. The fear, there's a fundamental fear that a lot of cops have when they see a black person, usually a black male. It's like their consciousness is filled with just the most fearsome alternative event they can imagine. They imagine being killed by this person, whether they have a weapon or not. But even when they're unarmed, they just think, this person can kill me. And that is a matter of psychology and who we let on the forces of America's police forces. You know, I have a column coming out this Tuesday about Fox Chapel Police put out a bulletin last week that said, attention, a light-skinned black man has been seen on whatever the road is, handing out political pamphlets. He's been sticking them on doors, and you know, because it's election time. And he's walking around, and he has a green jacket and so forth and so on. So, let us know if you see any suspicious characters. Now, this guy is just a pamphleteer. He's just putting things on doors and leaving. There's an all-points bulletin out for him. He's probably not even aware of it. And so he's going to do that, and someone's going to shoot him. That's what I'm talking about. It's a fear. It's like, you know, a Harvard professor is on his front porch of his home. His key is stuck in the door. He's trying to get into his own home. His chauffeur is helping him get into his own home on a nice street in Cambridge, a house that he owns. A cop arrives and says, "Who are you?" "Oh, I'm Professor, you know, Lewis Gates. This is my home." And he says, "Let's see some ID." He says, "This is my house." And we all know how that story ended up. You know, thank God he wasn't killed. But it became a big to-do and led to this sort of White House summit in which the president, you know, had a beer summit in which the president had the cop and Dr. Gates over for a beer to sort of work out this sort of like racial embarrassment. And apparently it did not work because these sorts of basic misunderstandings happen all the time. I think that this is where I think, on a practical level, the church, the black church, the white church, the church universal, whatever, could have a real positive effect if we made it clear as Christians that we expect all citizens to be treated equally. Yes.
On that note, I would just like to highlight two things that I can think of possibly now. Reverend William Barber, do you know him?
How do I know the name? Yes. Moral Mondays. Yeah.
This is I think he's a Baptist. But that's
yes, he is. It's those Baptists again. Yes. 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 Yes, those are two excellent suggestions, and I was remiss in not bringing up, you know, the brother in North Carolina, because that is exact. He's trying to restart that Christian impetus for civil rights. That's an excellent example, and there are many. I think that, you know, black churches are crying. You know, they need a sense of moral centeredness again, and I think that I think if white churches were to say, "Hey, we're interested in partnering with you on some of these things," if the black church wasn't thinking about it before, it will certainly think about it then. You know, because it needs to be done. So, yeah, we gotta cut it short here, folks. But I think we have time for one quickie. Okay. No, 3 or 4 days is not going to do it. It needs to happen at the academy level, you know, like when they're going through the 3 months of police academy, that's where it needs to happen, and it needs to be every day.
But the older ones aren't
going to
be going back.
No, the older ones are. Yeah, we just have to like get through this period of the older ones. But they're starting to retire at record numbers. I mean, the police forces all across the country are facing declines. They're just, people aren't coming in to take those jobs, and the older guys are stepping back because no one wants to be associated with police forces that are, that have implicit bias problems, and that's what's happening there. So we're going to be in a crisis in a few years because we just won't have enough cops, especially in the big cities, to do anything, and we don't have young people yearning to be cops right now because they think that it's a very oppressive occupation.
What do you think is the answer to that?
I think, like I said, I think it's really a matter of churches, social service organizations, folks coming together and saying, we got to change the psychology out there. We got to change the psychology of the resentment and hatred that a lot of black kids have for the law enforcement. We've got to change that whole culture of, looking the other way whenever there's crime. But the thing is that if you call the cops now, the cops may come and shoot you. If I'm a black guy in the hill, I'm saying, hey, my neighbor is doing this and that and so forth, and the cops come, and I'm standing on my front porch, and he thinks that I'm big, he might kill me. He might think that I'm the trouble. And that's the problem. So thank you for your patience, and thanks.